On June 14, 1940, German tanks entered a silent and deserted Paris. The City of Light was occupied by the Third Reich. Parisians were stunned, humiliated, and yet curious about the sudden appearance of thousands of German soldiers on their boulevards. The Germans, too, were curious. How do you treat a city that did not fire a shot in its own defense? Marking the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Paris, Ronald Rosbottom has written the new book, When Paris Went Dark, The City of Light Under German Occupation, 1940 to 1944. It is a great pleasure to welcome Ronald Rosbottom to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
That's my pleasure.
You are a professor of French and European studies at Amherst College and have also served as the dean of the faculty. Give us a sense of what brought you to this subject.
I started a few years ago teaching a freshman seminar on the history of Paris because I've always loved the city. I went there as a high school junior, and a college junior, and I have always been fascinated, returned often, and so I decided I'd give a course on the history of modern Paris. And I got more and more interested in what it must have been like to have lived there on a daily basis under the German occupation. And I kept reading a little bit, and then a few years ago, I got very interested in the fact that Hitler had visited Paris for only once in his life, right after his troops had marched in, and stayed only 3 hours. But he took a tour, the same tour you would take if you were caught between flights in Paris. And I said, I'd like to write something on that tour. It's a fascinating meeting of Adolf Hitler in a city I love. And from there came the book. I just got hooked and kept getting deeper and deeper into it and getting more and more interested in daily life, and so the result is When Paris Went Dark.
It is interesting to note that tour that Hitler took was very soon after the German tanks entered the city. It was the same month and the same year. What was the occupation of the city like at that point, and then from there something that lasted for 4 years?
4 years, right. And no one, neither the Germans nor the French, expected it to last 4 years. At first, the Germans were very polite. In fact, the French used the word correct all the time. They were very correct, polite, because Hitler and the Nazis wanted to send a signal to the rest of the world that they could be civilized, that they weren't the monsters that indeed they were. And they kept open jazz clubs, nightclubs, even the bordellos. They sent photographs and films around the world showing how comfortably the Germans were fitting into Paris. That lasted, and the Parisians were stunned by the defeat of the French army, so they were humiliated and quiet. So there was no the first year of the occupation was relatively peaceful. And then when Hitler arrived there for his brief visit after only 2 weeks, his army had arrived 2 weeks earlier. He arrived on a Sunday morning. It was a very empty city, and when you see films of his visit, you get the sense that the city was dead. That is, the buildings were still there, but there was no one on the streets. It was very quiet. Things began to change during the first winter. It got cold. The Germans were stealing everything they could from France, coal, horses, cattle, locomotives, everything they could get they were stealing to send back to Germany to prepare for the invasion of Russia, which no one knew was coming at that time. And then slowly, with each year that passed, the Germans tightened their hold on the city, and the resistance, the French resistance, got stronger and stronger and more active. Charles de Gaulle was broadcasting from London that the Frenchmen should resist. And then the Germans started getting beaten in Russia, and the result was that they had to put more and more pressure on on France to keep it quiet so that they could send their troops to Russia. And so it just got worse and worse and worse until by the end of the occupation, there was none of that correctness or friendliness or kind of mutual decency that had occurred in the first part.
You write in the introduction to the book how Paris was different, and you write that Paris's arrogance made it a metropolis more difficult to occupy than any of the other European cities the Nazis controlled by force between 1939 and 1945. How so? Describe a little bit about that arrogance.
Well, it's a classic definition of the French, is they do have a certain self-confidence about their culture and their history. For those few brief moments, they weren't arrogant. They were humiliated, the Parisians, they were humiliated, they were embarrassed, they felt guilty. They were trying to blame each other about why France had fallen so quickly. But very quickly, that kind of Parisian self-confidence came back. And very quickly, they began sending signals to the Germans through humor sometimes, passing around tracts and mimeograph posters that they weren't happy with the occupation. The other problem is that France, or the other problem for the Germans, was that France was the most, because of that sort of self-confidence and arrogance, one of the most beloved and best-known international cities. So everyone was watching in Buenos Aires, in Santiago, in Los Angeles, in Shanghai. Everyone was watching to see how Paris would react. And I think the Parisians finally began to realize that they were Parisians and began to reassume that kind of self-confidence and arrogance that they had had before. But for 6 months to 8 months, they were just as stunned as everybody else to see Germans walking around on their streets. But it was quite different from Oslo and Copenhagen and,
right,
and the rest of those countries. And of course, they never got to London.
And in the introduction to the book, you talk about how, while those places of London or Moscow, everyone was preparing, though. Paris was certainly preparing for an occupation. You show a picture in the book of the Louvre emptied.
Right. They were preparing for not necessarily an occupation. They were preparing for bombing because the Spanish Civil War, cities had been bombed for the first time indiscriminately. And every European city then realized that if there is a war, we could be bombed. And where are our major museums? Right in the center of the city. The Rijksmuseum and the National Gallery. And so a lot of those curators emptied as quickly as they could their museums. Also, just in case they were taken, they wanted to protect their pieces from looting because many of these collections were built on the fact that they had been looted from other countries, too. Looting had gone away. Napoleon was one of the great looters of all time. The Louvre is filled with works that Napoleon looted. So they were trying to protect from bombing, and they were trying to protect from looting, and so they took, beginning in the late 30s, they took a lot of their most valuable pieces and hid them all over France and even buried some of the statues. But I don't think the French had the strongest army in Europe. They didn't think they were going to be defeated. The Germans had tried twice to had almost gotten Paris twice in World War One and had never reached it. So the French were just stunned by this. It happened in 6 weeks. 6 weeks is what it took from May 10th to June 14th when they took over Paris.
We're speaking with Ronald Rossbottom. The name of the book is When Paris Went Dark, The City of Light Under German Occupation, published by Little Brown. You detail what it was like being Jewish in Paris during this time. Describe that a little.
Well, the Jewish population was complex because there were a lot of French Jews. Jews had been there for centuries. There were some recently naturalized French Jews from North Africa, and there were a lot of immigrants. non-naturalized, non-French Jews who had come from the East beginning in the late 30s, well, beginning from Germany and then from Czechoslovakia and Austria, since the Reich had come to power in 1933. So there was there were about 350,000 Jews in France at that time. About half of them were immigrants, about half of them were French. The French Jews felt pretty protected. After all, we're French, our republic will protect us, and then later Vichy will protect us. My grandfather, my father fought in the First World War. They're not going to take Jewish veterans. And for a while, that was true. The poor immigrants, especially the German immigrants, were the first rounded up and sent east. No one knew why they were being sent east at that point. At first, it was just labor camps, and then slowly the systematic murdering of Jews began to take place. But for a while, Jews just put their heads down, and, well, some left. Some went into the unoccupied zone, and some came to America and England, etc. But many just put their heads down and said, maybe if I keep quiet, they won't get me. And the poor Jews said, they're only going after the rich Jews. And the rich Jews said, they're not going to touch us because we control too much business. And, of course, they were all wrong. And then in 1942, the Germans said that every Jew, foreign and domestic, must wear a yellow star, which I think was probably the biggest mistake the Germans made. But by forcing every Jew to wear a star, they, in effect, publicized their racial policy to Gentiles. And they forced every Gentile to have to make a moral or a decision about whether to shake hands, say hello, continue to hang out with their Jewish friends, etc. And slowly it began dawning on the Jews that no one was safe. No one was safe, either the rich or the poor, the naturalized citizens or the French citizens. So it was not and then they had roundups right to the end. The last train left for Auschwitz from Paris about a week before the liberation. That's how fanatic the Germans were in sending them east. The week before, when there should be using these trains to get their soldiers out of Paris, they're loading them up with Jews and sending them east.
Yes, you write in the book, one of the most difficult things to understand about this period is why the Germans, anxious about the impending loss of Paris, continued the roundups of Jews and why they continue to execute hostages.
Yes, they continued. This shows you how insane that policy was, the anti-Semitic policy of the Reich. At a time when they should be using their railroads and their boxcars and their locomotives and their highways to move their troops back and forth between the East and West Front, when they're being clobbered on both ends, they are still spending an enormous amount of energy, effort, and manpower to round Jews up and sending them east to camps that they have in Poland and Germany. It was an obsession that, to me, is still difficult to understand. When their armies are dying for materiel and men, they're still wasting all of that military effort on killing millions of innocent people. I think that's one of the most difficult things to understand, is the depth of, you know, hate on the part of the Reich, not all Germans, but the Nazis, toward the Jewish menace, or what they considered to be the Jewish menace.
When the liberation came, you entitled the chapter Liberation, A Whodunit. What are the mysteries there?
Well, the big mysteries is everyone wants to take credit for having been dominant in liberating Paris. The communists wanted to take credit. De Gaulle wanted to take credit. The moderates and the socialists wanted to take credit. The French army that under De Gaulle wanted to take credit. The Americans wanted to take credit. So they were all involved, by the way. There was no one that did not, none of those people I mentioned, also the resistance, I forget, the resistance, the non-communist resistance, all of them participated, but they each began to struggle about who was more responsible because they were fighting over the political pie that was going to be the new France after the liberation. So there was a low level civil war that was going on. What's interesting about deliberation is that Eisenhower did not want to liberate Paris. He wanted to send his troops as quickly as he could after the great breakout from Normandy to the Rhine. He wanted to end that war by Christmas of 1944. And he knew that to liberate Paris was going to take an enormous amount of materiel and supplies. You're responsible for 1.5 million people. You have to feed them, you have to clothe them, you have to make sure that they're protected. And up until just a few weeks before it happened, he didn't want to do it. Roosevelt supported him. And finally, de Gaulle won out. And finally, because he threatened, he said, if you don't help us, I'm going to call for an uprising in Paris, and then you'll have to go in because otherwise people will be slaughtered, Paris will be destroyed like Warsaw was. So de Gaulle really he was really very tough, and it was, and for that reason, Americans finally supported it, let the French army go in first, and quickly followed them. But they found themselves confronted with this all this pent up bitterness, this desire to take credit, the people trying to get even with each other for whom if they considered to be inappropriate activity during the war. It was a mess. It was a year of arbitrary kangaroo courts, assassinations. They shaved women's heads who they suspected of either sleeping with the enemy or else having benefited too much from business with the enemy. It was not a pretty sight, and de Gaulle, his only interest was to unify the country, and he kept selling this idea that all of the French resisted, and that all the French, that the Vichy government was an aberration, and that the French were united, but underneath he was petrified of the Communist Party.
So as we wrap up and we look at the 70 years since the liberation, how has that played into our relationship with Paris and France as a whole over that time, and where are we now?
It took them a long time to come to grips with the fact that they had signed the armistice with Nazi Germany, the only country to do that, to sign an armistice and in effect have independence over a certain amount of the country. It took them a long time to admit there have been some very major figures who collaborated very closely with the Germans and some who remained in the French government well after the war. It took them a long time to bring into the classrooms and into historical discourse a honest analysis of what had happened. It wasn't until the 70s, and it was primarily an American, Robert Paxton, who first drew attention to the fact that the Vichy government was French. It wasn't an aberration. It was a French government, very conservative, very right-wing, but a French government nonetheless. But Mitterrand, who was president from about 1990 to, 2004 or something like that. I have to get my dates straight. But even he would have a flower laid at Pétain's grave, Pétain, who had headed the Vichy government, on his birthday. It's a question that still comes up. It comes up with the right wing in France now as who were the true patriots. There's a lot of anti-Semitism going on in France now, mostly on the part of young Muslims who are anti-Israel. But it brings up all those memories again of what did you do during the war? What did Gentiles do? How did they protect their Jewish citizens, their Jewish co-citizens? So it's still there. There are still people who will defend Pétain and that government. It's still there, But at least they're working it out. At least they're being honest about it. At least they're not hiding it. But it is that war and that occupation has marked Paris and still in many ways marks Parisian society.
The name of the book is When Paris Went Dark, The City of White Under German Occupation, 1940 to 1944. Ronald Rossbottom is the author. It is published by Little Brown. Ronald, thank you very much for spending time with us. I do appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for your good questions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Again, the title of the book, When Paris Went Dark, The City of White Under German Occupation. The book is published by Little Brown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.